Welcome back, podcast listeners. This is Andrew Bilt, and I am down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. This podcast has been a long time coming. Haven't done a podcast in almost a month now. It's been a while. Been busy with board studying, trying to get a job, trying to get some cornflakes, if you know what I'm saying. But all that is coming to a close. All that is wrapping up. We have some excellent, excellent podcast ideas coming up in the future. Have a few extra or special guests joining me for podcasts coming up here in the future. I think that you will like them all. This podcast is being released on March 31st. On April 3rd, I am heading down to Puerto Rico for a medical conference. If you are also going to be in Puerto Rico, either April 3rd through April 7th, let me know. Tweet me. Email me. Let me know where you're at. Let's meet up. Let's have a drink. Maybe I'll learn something from you. You'll learn something from me. Or maybe we just really won't learn anything. But let's meet up if you listen to this podcast. I think this podcast is actually a accumulation of a recent CME I gave called Introducing the Podcast. And in the podcast, the whole point of podcasts in general is to listen and get information and knowledge and that you otherwise would never be exposed to. So inside this lecture, I broke down some myths, if you will, some medical knowledge bombs, some pearls. If you've heard this piece before, if you've heard this lecture before, then I am sorry. And if you haven't, then this one is a good one. I'm not going to do all the pearls. I'm not going to give away everything, but I'm going to give away a couple of them. Maybe my two favorite myths we're going to talk about in this one. So without further ado, let's kick it off. Question Medicine 2016. All right, here we go. Little Mythbusters, a little time to say, what is the podcast all about? I mean, the podcast for me, I think the SGEM best describes it is it's trying to bridge that knowledge gap, trying to bring everything down so what we know and what we do become one and the same. Because in medicine, too often what we know and what we do are two different things. In 1992, in the Annals of Emergency Medicine, the Ottawa Ankle Criteria came out, and it was amazing at 100% sensitivity to pick up ankle fractures. The badness in ankles, the things that we care about in ankles. In 2001, so nearly 9 years later, they asked a bunch of ER physicians, and they said, do you know of the Ottawa Ankle Criteria? 90% of them knew of the Ottawa Ankle Criteria. And then they said, do you use the Ottawa Ankle Criteria? And only 35% of the physicians actually used the Ottawa Ankle Criteria. Again, there's a difference in what we know and what we do. And the longer it takes to bridge that gap, the more the system suffers, the more the provider suffers, and more importantly, the more the patient suffers. So let's jump in. What are some myths? What are some things we know or don't know? What are some things we can do? I think we got to start basic. We got to start real basic. And one of the most common myths, one of the most common things I've heard, I even said it, I am guilty of even saying it, is when a patient asks, how much water should I drink? It's always 8 8-ounce glasses of water, or 8 12-ounce glasses of water, or 8 glasses of water. That's the belief. It's 8 glasses of water. Where did that even come from? How did we pull 8 out of the sky? Why not 9? Why not 7.5? What is the science behind it? So in order to know where we're at, we got to know where we've been. And let's go all the way back to 1945, the Food and Nutrition Board of National Academy of Sciences, their recommended dietary allowance came out. And in that document, you can Google it, it's online, and I'll update the website. I know I have not updated the website from the last podcast, but I will update the website here, and with this, we'll be on there. In that article, it does say, a suitable allowance of water for adults is 2.5 liters daily in most instances, period. That's it. That's the quote. That is it. And now I know you're saying, well, Andrew, obviously that is where this recommendation comes from. But you see, if you go actually read the article, you may see they just might have got it wrong. And maybe the media over time has twisted or turned the words just a little bit to make it fit what they want to say. Maybe even textbooks. Maybe we, somewhere along the line, as physicians, have even twisted it just a little bit. And so we don't have it quite right. We don't have quite the wording. Because although it does say a suitable allowance of water for adults is 2.5 liters daily in most instances, if you read on, literally the very next line says, most of this quantity is contained in prepared foods. Yeah, that's right. Most of it is contained in prepared foods. Meaning, you don't need it. You don't need to drink 2.5 liters because most of it's coming in your food. So there's myth number one. What is the right amount of water? Maybe 2.5 liters. When your patient asks, how much water should you be drinking? I've actually tried to look into this. I can't find an exact answer. I tell my patients who are healthy without, you know, CKD or anything like that, CHF, I know I'm going to get some emails saying, well, Andrew, what about this? Anyways, generally healthy patients, I tell them, drink water until your pee is pretty clear. Till your urine is clear, that's about a good rule of thumb. If it's dark yellow, not so good. If it's just a little bit of a light yellow, that's probably okay. That's what I tell them. I can't really find any evidence on this. If you have evidence, I would be happy to read, share, send, post to the website. Let me know if you actually have evidence on how much you should be having. But I suspect there's no precise answer because we're just not going to have randomized controlled trials to really give us that information, I think. So that was myth number one. And like I said, I'm only going to do two myths today. This is just going to be a short little podcast. The main part of this is just to get a podcast out there because I know it's been so long since we've done a podcast. And to tell you, if you're going down to Puerto Rico, you're heading to Puerto Rico the beginning of April here, let me know. Hit me up on Twitter. Email me. Let's figure it out. All right. This next one is strep throat. Strep throat. Do we give antibiotics? Do we not give antibiotics? We have the Centaur criteria. How many Centaur criteria should we actually use, or should we even use the Centaur criteria? Well, let's look into this a little bit deeper. You see, why do we even treat strep throat with antibiotics? It's not to decrease the pain. It is definitely not to decrease the pain. There have been studies that show Tylenol and ibuprofen are equal in treating pain compared to, or actually even better in treating pain compared to the antibiotics. So it's not the pain. It's not the pain of the sore throat. It's to prevent rheumatic fever. And what an ironic thing that rheumatic fever, the thing we care about with rheumatic fever, is nothing to do with the fever. It's the carditis from the heart failure. But let's look at this strep throat issue just a little closer. So we got to go back. We got to go all the way back to JAMA 1950 by Denny et al. And I'm not talking about Denny as in Denny's Grand Slam, although that does sound pretty good right now. I am talking about a military camp in the middle of Wyoming. Oh yes, a military camp in the middle of Wyoming in the late 1940s, early 1950s. You see, before this time period, strep throat, not a big deal. We didn't really care about it. Why did we not really care about it? Because we had more serious things to deal with, like diphtheria. But thanks to immunizations, and this was before media and Jenny McCarthy and the anti-vaxxers pushing their way through, strep throat, not a big deal because we had bigger concerns, bigger problems. But I believe it was Puff Daddy that said, more money, more problems. This is the same thing in medicine. More cures, more diseases. The more cures we have, the more diseases we can come up with. All of a sudden, the things that were really important are now cured or better, and now we can find other diseases and illnesses to make a big deal out of. So, in 1950, Denny et al., JAMA, like I said, I'll put the link to this on the website. If you can't get access to the paper, let me know, and we'll see what we can do for you. It had 1,600 military recruits. They came in with strep throat, and they got 300,000 units of PenG-IM on day one of admission, and then again 72 hours later. Now, that part I gotta say is important because this is the study. This is the one that we base our treatments off currently. However, currently, we don't give, at least I never have given anyone penicillin on day one and then again 3 days later. I give it to them consecutively, not day one and day four. So that's interesting. Those that were treated had a less than 1% rheumatic fever. And those not treated were just under 3%. That's about a 2% difference, which leads to an NNT of around 50 or 60. That's pretty good. That's about the numbers for aspirin on secondary prevention. But there's a problem. And it's not more money, more problems. It's not more diagnoses, more problems. It's the problem that that was then and this is now. You see, that was a 3% case rate based on one military base in Wyoming in the 1940s. That number has never been duplicated. Not even close to duplicated. Not even like sort of, it could be kind of duplicated. Like, no, it has not ever been duplicated. In fact, there are only two other cases of rheumatic fever in a pharyngitis study, and both of those were in 1961. One out of 100,000 by most conservative measures in the wilderness sticks of Australia, the far-fetched land of Africa, may develop rheumatic fever. But when the incidence dropped to less than 1 in a million in the general population in 1994, the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, stopped actually even tracking rheumatic fever. They said, we don't even care anymore. This is so rare. This is so uncommon. This is so unbelievable that we are even wasting resources on this. We don't have to worry about this anymore. And you might be saying, well, I mean, come on, what's the big deal? Even if it's only 1 in a million, that's 1 in a million, and we should treat it because it's still 1 in a million. It's one person that we're saving. But as we have mentioned on this podcast before, as we mention all the time, no drug is benign. The numbers needed to harm for antibiotics, just run these over your brain. 5 to 8 for diarrhea, 25 to 30 for a yeast infection, 25 to 30 for a diaper rash, so essentially a yeast infection. 1 out of every 2 to 3,000 will have anaphylaxis, and 1 out of every 3 to 4,000 will have Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Drugs aren't benign. When we have 1 out of every 5 and 8 developing diarrhea, but 1 out of a million developing rheumatic fever, and 1 out of 3,000 on the upper side having anaphylaxis, there is no doubt in my mind, there is literally no doubt at all that we are doing more bad than good. More badness than goodness is coming from our treatment. If we took an oath to do no harm, the no harm has to sometimes be do nothing. Act real fast to do nothing. Don't just do something, stand there. You get the idea. We gotta just sometimes take a look at what we're doing and question it. Question our own medicine. Now, myth busting is a blast, and maybe I'll do more myth bust in the future. Let me know if you like this kind of format, this kind of style. It's kind of what Question Medicine is based on. Maybe some myth busting. And the whole point in this wrapped up little CME piece that I gave was there's a difference in what we know and what we do. We know that treating strep throat is not good. We know it is not beneficial. There is more bad than good that come from it. But yet we continue to do it. And in America, at least in America, not in the sticks or the wilderness of Australia, but here in America, it is not beneficial and we shouldn't be doing it. We have to at some point stand up as a medical community and say, we are going to do what's good for each individualized nation, each individualized location. Because in the end, we ultimately got to do what's good for each individual patient. And with that, I think I have rambled. I think I've ranted enough. Let me know if you like this format. If you are going to be in Puerto Rico April 3rd through 7th, let me know. Hit me up on Twitter. Let's meet up. Let's hang out. And until next time I'm on here, which I can promise you will be a lot sooner than this most recent time, and I can also promise you I will get that website updated. Keep your quest in questioning.